It is Saturday, January 26th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and during the entire hour, geek calls, which means you can call in with questions and comments about technology.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on Geek Speak, we'll take your calls throughout the show. Our number is 800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again over and over again, so just get a pencil, and next time I say it, dial or write it down. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Prim. She's a mediator, printmaker, and broadcaster at large. Good morning, Bonnie.
Feeling large today.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. So we're going to jump right into interesting things that happened this week. But I guess I got to say that last week, the show was fun and a lot of laughter. Three geeks and me, so four people in the air room. All of us had something to say and something to joke about. Yeah. And, you know, regularly I try to listen. As good radio people, we try to improve what we do all the time. Mm-hmm. So on the ride in this morning, that's what I did as I listened to the show. Of course, I should have done it in the middle of the week, but instead I did it this morning. And I got to say, I laughed a lot. And I also saw the complaint that came from a very technical friend of mine, right?
We had a complaint.
Yeah, yeah. That's what actually initiated my thought process on it and the reason why I had to listen to it before the show. Mm-hmm. And what the comment was, I won't quote it exactly, but the comment in general was, hey, that was really laughy. What about more geeky? And so I...
Do we miss conveying some information that wanted to be conveyed?
Well, I don't know. I think we did a pretty good job. I mean, the description that the thing I thought about throughout the week a bit about the show was that we talked about the Java exploit. That's been a big news, and it's always this problem.
And, you know, in truth, I'm still a little fuzzy on it.
Yeah, exactly. That's because we talked about banana slugs to cover it last week. Oh, yeah. And I highly recommend, actually, I laughed a lot in the car. I highly recommend listening to last week's show if you're curious about hearing ridiculous metaphors about Java exploits. But the reason why I avoided the topic in a more detailed way is that to give you a really good understanding of what's happening, I have to talk about machine code and runtime environments. Mm-hmm. And that description just, you have to build up a giant stack of baseline information to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So what I did instead is I kind of made this funny story and an analogy, and I thought it was pretty good, but we all laughed a lot, too much probably. Yeah. but then I said, go read the article. And actually, I've got a simple solution that I can express on the radio. So this is what you do about the Java exploit.
Okay.
You
want to hear it? Yeah. I need 2 seconds on what the Java, perceived Java problem is. And then let's talk about a solution.
All right. So just a recap of last week's story. The concept was that it hit the news pretty clearly that a lot of people are suggesting to disable Java on your computer. Deinstall it.
All right. And why?
And because you can, somebody remotely can control your machine without your knowledge and without your saying yes, if you have Java and this exploit still exists. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that you can't actually patch the Java runtime environment to make it safe, so disable it. Okay. Now, this is in the security circles, this is said all the time. And the problem is it's hard to get people to understand when they need to act in certain ways. You know, people are just casual on their computers, which is fine. That's what you want to do. And in this situation, you can't be casual. You have to have a little bit of action. Just like we say, make sure you have good passwords. This is the same type of thing. Okay. So the idea is this. What I'm going to suggest to people is you use a browser like Chrome or Firefox. I know both of these fix the problem in some ways.
Okay.
Use the most recent version of this. This only works for people that have more recent computers, unfortunately, but I highly recommend you using the most recent Chrome or Firefox. And when you do that, as you're using that as your browser, by default, Java will be disabled. They'll fix the problem.
So you've got two browsers up, and you use one just for Java stuff?
What I'm saying is you can use Chrome or Firefox, and this is the browser you should use all the time.
Okay.
One of those.
Specifically those two.
Set those as your default browser. Now, and then in the settings of that browser, disable Java. And that's not a very hard thing to do, but you'll need to look it up for either your browser. You can look at least last week's episode of Geek Speak. We have a link to those things.
Okay.
Okay. The Java explained.
All right.
So use one of those browsers, doesn't matter which one, and you're keeping it up to date. You get it turned on auto updates and you disable Java. Now you go to your bank site and the bank site needs Java. Let's say someplace needs Java. And now the question is, do you enable it? Well, you could enable it, but then you've got to disable it again later, right? And potentially the browser would help you and only enable it for this domain. But the simple solution is you have another browser on your computer. If you're running a Macintosh, you have Safari on your computer already. And on a Windows machine, you have Internet Explorer already. Mm-hmm. So all you do is you never use those two browsers for anything but that bank site that needs Java. And in those browsers, you allow it to be enabled.
I see.
So when you go and you go with Chrome or Firefox to a place and it says, enable Java, this isn't working, and you decide, oh, this is important. It's not just an ad or a game. It's actually important to me. Mm-hmm. You copy the URL. That's the location bar. You copy that whole thing. You open up Safari or Internet Explorer, the browser that has it unsafe, the unsafe space.
In your special browser just for that stuff.
You paste in that URL, and when you then visit that website, it'll work.
Okay.
And then you have to make sure that as you browse the internet, you're not using that browser. So you have to be a little more aware.
Yeah, get like, oh, actually, thing leads to another thing. You open another tab and off you go.
Right.
Now you've just corrupted, as it were,
that's right,
your special place for Java things.
Exactly. So that's the recommendation that I've got for
you. All right, got it.
All right.
A little discipline.
Yeah, a little discipline,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
All right.
All right, what do you got?
Things that happened this week.
Yeah.
I'm just going to admit that I played games with you this week.
Yes, we did.
That happened. And apparently it took. I heard you played again.
Yes. Okay. So tell me how describe monster cards to me.
Okay.
You taught this game to me last week.
I and my friend Wes did.
Yes.
Which I learned.
Our friend Wes.
Our friend
Wes. Okay,
good, good. Yes. It's delightful that we've got that crossover.
So
monster cards was originated by people who were frustrated that to play a game they had to collect a bunch of pre-made cards. And thought, well, geez bees, we can make our own darn cards. And so the game is basically you make cards, and they could be about anything.
And we're talking like playing cards,
Magic
the Gathering, that kind of thing. That's
the
expensive thing that you're
kind
of referring to.
Yeah, playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
Not like a deck of cards, but sort of collector cards that you also play against each other. So monster cards, you make your own darn cards, and then in a group you play them in pairs. And you know, like two members are playing, and then the rest of the group decides which card wins. And the cards can be anything. They can be like you're shy at the party. They can be plenty of kale in the CSA. That's one of my favorite ones. They can be
I love your eggplant one last week. Eggplant for dinner.
Yeah, eggplant for dinner.
Yeah.
Although, unfortunately, it was an uncooked eggplant for dinner, and that
has
less appeal.
That's why we decided not to vote on it.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming with monster cards, it's interesting. I did try to play this later in the week.
Okay,
it's to the next day.
Yeah,
with my very smart family. So the family, my direct ascendant's family in the community, right?
Yeah.
They're all have degrees, PhDs, and master degrees and stuff, and they're smart, art aware people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my thought is, well, this game will be perfect because all of them know how to draw and they can all make references to culture, and you know this will be great.
Yeah.
So I started to try to explain the game. The way I started is, originally, and I'm making this up as I do all the time, I'm assuming monster cards was very much about battling monsters. So you draw a picture of a monster, and I draw a picture of a monster, and we put them down, and everybody decide which monster would win the battle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's my assumption, I'm assuming. Do you think that's the history?
That seems like a fair assumption, and for the purposes of this radio program, yes.
We're going forward.
Yes.
So I explain, like, if you had a slime monster on one card and you had a Godzilla on the other card, the slime monster might actually win, because what can Godzilla do to slime, right? It can't smash it. It just comes back together. And the slime monster might be able to crawl up into its ear or something. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So that debate would happen after the cards were played. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
But we didn't play it that way, you and the people that were together with us last week, at all. In fact, we played this very no-rules kind of way, where you drew a picture of an eggplant, and my daughter drew a picture of
a fairy
battle or something, and she said fairies have power, and you said eggplant for dinner,
and
we debated which one would win.
Right.
Wait, but with no rule set at all.
No rule set at all, other than knowing that we could phone a friend if that friend had played monster cards previously, and in fact, we needed that friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that did happen during the game. We did get the feedback, and they broke the battle, or the tie.
Yeah.
So I tried to play this game the next day with this I don't want to say intellectual in a negative way, but I won't. I'll say intellectual group. And the thing that disturbed, I think, some of them is this didn't seem to have a lot of structure to this game. There weren't rules. You know, please draw something. What does that have to be? Can be anything. And then add a phrase. And that actually turned into a bit of a contention that we didn't have enough structure for them to feel like they could enjoy the game.
So it wasn't enough structure for them. And so what did they do?
Complained. It was a bit of complaint about the game.
Hey. So what about that, though?
I think the thing that was interesting to me is that as a geek, I'm interested in the meta of what's happening, right? So when I play a game, I'm not just playing the game. I'm thinking about why the rules are designed the way they are to make the game work. Mm-hmm. And in role-playing games, which I played for years, Dungeons and Dragons types of games, mm-hmm. you're continually very aware of the system's structure. Right. And one of the things that I did in D&D a lot is try, or in a role-playing game, is try to break that structure, try to come up right up to that sideline structure. And of course, when you do that, what ends up happening is the game master, the person that controls the game, has to decide what would make sense.
Right.
But it's also about how it would be enjoyable, how it would map the world realistically.
So there was something about having that lack of structure that made it unenjoyable, which is a main purpose of games.
I would say, for those people. But for me, because of that, that was a second level enjoyment for me. I was curious to why structure was so needed. Because of course, one of the side effects when you look at the evening that we had last week was, we all drew and talked about our drawings. Mm-hmm. I mean, when do you do that? That's why I loved it, right?
Right.
But it's hard to get people to draw and talk about their drawings. So the game structure is kind of important. So the question is how much structure needs to be there to have it be enjoyable but still have that pleasure of doing it.
So
that's what I thought was interesting and kind of geeky. You know, let me just say that you can call in right now with questions and comments about technology. We are taking any calls today. If you want to call in about your computer problems or concerns about non-structured games, you're welcome to do so. Yeah. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Of course, that phone number is toll-free across the United States and Canada and maybe in New Mexico. I'm not even sure where it is, but... did I say 1-800-655-5877?
I believe that is the number you said, yes. 1-800-655-5877. That's what I heard.
And that number, if you call in now, you can get in the queue and we'll take your questions and comments on air.
And you can get a geek answer and a freewheeling, uninformed answer. Special today only.
So I hope that we explained Monsters Cards well. This is Lyle Troxell and Bonnie Jean Premsch. We're in the air room in right next to the ocean in Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. and you're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP, of course. So we described Monster Cards well? I think so, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to describe. You draw things on cards, and then you play them against each other, and everyone decides which one's the awesomest.
It's just as simple as that.
Yeah.
So...
And you can opt either to have it be like the house collection and it stays at the venue where you played, or you can walk away with the cards that you won and have that be the basis of your own personal monster card deck that you can take with you and play.
Very cool.
There we go.
All right.
And we're going to hunt down examples of monster cards. And
yes, I've got a picture and I'll put it up on geekspeak.org. In fact, everything we talk about, we kind of cover on geekspeak.org as we go, which is always nice. I feel like we've got a call waiting, and I got to get to it. And I'm trying to find it in our thread. So I'm delaying for a moment. Isn't that horrible?
I see. Da, 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 da. And now a little hold music.
You know what? Maybe we're just not ready. So let me give people the phone number again. It's 800-655-5877. Oh, good. We've got Eric from Santa Cruz on the phone. And it sounds like it's totally appropriate. So let's do that. Hi, Eric. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, Lyle. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I wanted to follow up on your comment about using multiple browsers for different purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. I had turned off tracking or turned off cookies because mm-hmm. I don't like all these websites knowing everything about what I'm doing. And I would do the same thing. I'd use Firefox for my primary browser. And then once in a great while when I had to use Facebook, which I don't generally use, it wouldn't let me use it unless I turn cookies on, so I'd use IE for that.
Yeah.
But I recently got a new machine and running Windows 8, and for some reason, it doesn't seem to be working. Like, I can't access some websites that I used to be able to access without cookies.
Are you using Firefox or Chrome inside Windows 8, or are you using Internet Explorer? You are.
Oh, so, I mean, yes, I can't. So with my Firefox, which is my primary browser, before, like, my email is Yahoo, so I go there a lot. Now I can't get, when I turned off cookies, I can't get to my Yahoo Mail account.
Oh, interesting. Well, I mean, that it sounds, I mean, the reason why you wouldn't be able to do, when the cookies are off, it's difficult to get mail. What you're saying is that you used to be able to do the mail website logging in with the browser that had cookies disabled.
No, it could be that I'm misremembering how I had it set up. Maybe I just had cookies turned off for Facebook.
Right. Well, so let me suggest this. Turning off cookies by default across all your browsers is very difficult to do anything online now. It's very common for the companies to be sending you what's called a session cookie so that as you log in, you're logged in. But also as you browse their site, they kind of keep track of who you are. And their ad revenue, which is most likely the most site's revenue, is based partially off of the ability to find out who you are at the level of that you're unique and you've done these things, right? It's not like they know your name or anything, but they right. know that you're a person with a certain number, if you will. They have a number for you. So it's very difficult for a website to have those things turned off and still function. In fact, sometimes they'll set up a warning. And in any application where you have to log in, you kind of have to have sessions and cookies enabled. But I recommend this. Firefox and Chrome, and I think maybe Safari too, have this concept of incognito. And an incognito new window, an incognito, means that window will not have any association with any other windows. So let's say you don't have cookies disabled. You have cookies working and functional. And you go and log in your email. And then you want to go click on a link or something. You open a new incognito window and you copy that link and paste it into the new window. What you've done now, and sometimes you can actually right-click on the link in one window and say open in a new window incognito. And then what you've done is you've disassociated your session space. You know, you still have sessions enabled, but the only thing they know about it is that you've gone to that one page. So that's what I recommend instead of disabling cookies.
I think in Firefox they call that private browsing.
Yeah, private browsing. Private browsing incognito. Thank you for that term.
And then maybe one other question, so if you have time. I was wondering if you could comment on the Intel has a quad-core processor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to evaluate whether getting a higher speed, not quad-core, like a dual-core, versus a lower clock rate quad-core, how, if you know some site that's done.
Are you, so what I'd ask right away, are you a big gamer? Do you do 3D rendering? Are you using, do you have applications that you know are going to split tasks across multiple browsers, or multiple processors?
I don't do anything fancy.
It's not going to matter then.
So the higher clock speed would be better?
No. For you, go for price. Because what's happening here is that it is true that a quad-core, lower clock speed quad-core is actually going to perform better in some situations than a higher speed dual core. But knowing that and which application is going to function which way, would the amount of difference is not significant in your life. You know, like it won't matter to you. You won't see the effect. And that's just to say, unless you say very specifically this unit compared to this unit, which one's better, I think that the color of the keys on the keyboard is a more important decision for most people. Because it's really, that is not going to slow things down at the level you'd think. Now, multiple cores, if the software you're using, you actually, I think I'm going to leave it at that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
What about solid state disk versus just regular RAM?
Oh, just more RAM. I think that getting RAM is really important. Let's see. Here's the thing that's amazing
to me.
Yeah.
Solid state disk versus a regular disk.
The best thing you can do for performance on your computer is get a solid state hard drive. Uh-huh. That being said, The cheaper solid state hard drives have a way that they save bits that's actually very inefficient, and you really want to look at. But the expensive ones, excuse me, the ones that are server space are really expensive, but they're made very much much better. So if you've got an older computer, let's say you've got a 3-year-old computer, you don't have an SSD in it, a solid state hard drive, you've got a normal hard drive on it. If you get a new computer, you know, buy today anything that's new. The mid-range, not the real expensive one, not the real cheap one, the kind of mid-range thing, and you get one with a solid-state drive, the experience for you is going to be so phenomenally faster that the detail of which could be the best is not going to matter again, right? It'll be such a good experience. So you do want a solid-state drive. You do not want the cheapest solid-state drive possible. I would look at the machine you're going to buy with solid-state. I would look at some online reviews. Amazon's a wonderful place to do that, even if you're not buying from there, because there's a lot of users. And the ranking's important. Don't pay attention to, you know, one or two, one star, because that might have just been a bad experience the person had. Look at the average feeling. And a solid-state drive, the cheap ones are not great. How about that? But definitely get a solid-state drive if you can afford it.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Bye.
If you'd like to call in with questions or comments about technology, we're taking the calls the whole hour. 800-655-5877 is the phone number. Again, 800-655-5877. Well, we're in the middle of the show, and sometimes what we do in the middle of the show is show some geek bits. Now, this is a little story that we think is interesting that you really have to see to believe. Yeah. So, Bonnie, got one of those?
Well, apparently a giant squid has been caught on video for the very first time. And there is a way to kind of get a look at what a real live giant squid looks like in motion.
Oh, cool.
Very exciting.
All right.
We're going to link to a story that talks about how they sort of got it on film in the first place. And
Fantastic. Apparently
it takes a lot of patience and cash. Those are the things that it required.
Or so the researchers say.
Or so the researchers say. Who knows what the real truth is? You can see for yourself.
And just go to geekspeak.org.
Just go to geekspeak.org.
And well, that'll be up in just a few minutes. I'm actually adding it right now. The story that I've got, and I'll tell you in just a second, is about a really cool resume. But first, what's going on tomorrow on KUSP?
Oh, on KUSP, of course, at high noon. It's one of the highlights of this entire radio station, if you ask me. It is the 7th Avenue Project with Robert Pauly. And tomorrow at noon, it's a story about midlife. Midlife, Marianne Fisher Girlando's sociology career took an unexpected turn. She started teaching in prisons, and she liked it so much, she never looked back. She's going to talk to KUSP's Robert Pauly about her decades working in one of America's most notorious penitentiaries, Angola State Prison in Louisiana. They're going to discuss life in the big house, criminal justice in America, and why she prefers men's prisons to women's prisons. Well, I'm very curious about that. Anyway, that'll be tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project at high noon here on KUSP, or later in podcast form. You can go to KUSP.org and hear it that way also.
Thank you. And of course, we're geekspeak.org. And one of the things on geekspeak.org is Phil Dub. Okay, let me explain.
Yeah, what is this Phil Dub?
Philip DuPost is a web product manager.
Okay.
It's actually his tasks and what he does, if you described it to most every human on the planet, would be the same as what I do. Okay. But we do different things.
All right.
But that's detail.
Okay.
He has this great resume, and what he did is he took the Amazon product page idea, and he made a resume of himself as an item on yeah, exactly.
This is delightful.
So here it is. The title of the Amazon-looking post is Philip DuPost, Web Product Manager. Mm-hmm. Only one left in stock. Order soon. Mm-hmm. And then in these product details, he's got the dimensions, height. He's got 186 centimeters of shipping. This item is available for shipping anywhere in the world. Languages, English, French, Spanish. Best marathon time, 3 hours and 22 minutes. Average
so
customer
nice
reviews.
Random facts in there as well as some relevant things if you wanted to hire his services.
Right. And of course, he has education in there and main skill ranking. It's like different his skills. Yeah. But the thing that's wonderful about it is that you, when you go there, because all of us are so familiar with Facebook, it's so much like Facebook. And I think...
Oh, you mean Amazon, right?
I'm sorry, Amazon.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's so much like Amazon. It looks completely
dead
like...
Dead on.
Yeah, yeah.
Dead on, yeah.
And of course, he's getting overwhelming hits. It's a wonderful resume.
Great. Very clever.
Yeah. And I'm also curious if he, you know, how much of this is an app and how much this is just a profile. It could be something that he could actually develop into a service. But of course, if he did that, Amazon would probably have a problem with his playing with their name and such.
Yes, and their look.
Yeah.
Their intellectual property.
So if you're curious about that, it'll be up at geekspeak.org in just a few minutes. Let's go ahead and start going back to calls, I think, because since we've got them, why not take people from, I don't know, places like San Jose, where luckily Tony's calling with a question. Hi, Tony. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi, Lyle. Thank you. I have a question about AT&T's TSL service versus their UVerse service for internet, internet only. I currently have AT&T's ADSL at 3 megabits, and I was concerned that it was kind of getting pricey and the speed was slow. Mm-hmm. And so I called them up, and they said, oh, well, we'll offer you 6 megabits on the special promotion price, and but it's UVerse, and we'll send you a modem, and don't worry, it's easy to connect. So I get the modem, and I find it's a two-wire 30 model 3600 HGV, and it's kind of got a built-in wireless and a built-in router,
okay,
as well as whatever the modem is for UVerse. And by the way, it uses the same copper wire on my telephone as my old ADSL.
And you just feel a little slimy, right? You feel like they're doing something weird here.
Is that it, or are we mapping our own thoughts onto your
experience? That's how I'm feeling. Go on.
Yeah, the wireless part is Hyper G, and so it's 802.11G of some flavor. And then the security that they offer is either WEP 64, WEP 128, or WPA.
Okay.
But currently, and with my my router plus separate Airport Express, I have 811N, and I have WPA 2 security. And I'm wondering, am I actually making a step backwards here? Is this a good deal or not?
I have my own non-geeky opinion on whether or not to go with AT&T UVerse based on customer support and communication within the company that makes it possible for you to get what you need, which is to say, it is impossible for you to get what you need if you're dealing with AT&T UVerse, though they are in the business of being a conduit for information. They do a lousy job of taking care of their information in-house such that you cannot get anywhere with them.
Okay. Good.
Here's
my mostly rant but some technical information. First off, UVerse is DSL. They are not selling anything new, except they call it something else. And the reason they call it something else, in my opinion, is that cable is such a better deal for speed and performance than DSL. So they have to compete with the cable company. And to do that, to say, oh, we offer DSL, it's fast DSL, already in people's mind, people understand that cable modems are faster than DSL. And so they wrap it in a term called UVerse. All it is a new service provided by AT&T that's delivered most of the time through DSL. Now, what they're selling to you is a certain megabits per second. And that right there is the important part, right, as we know. Whether they deliver that through DSL or some other means isn't really important. And that's why they're packaging like that, right? Because it's actually, in some areas, they might roll out a Wi-Fi capability system, right? And since you're buying 6 megabit UVerse, they could deliver you a new modem that would use a Wi-Fi protocol for the connection to the internet, not for the in-house. So the other thing they're doing, of course, is that since it's a package deal, they're giving you a wireless modem as well, a Wi-Fi access point built into the modem. And the reason they're doing that is most customers want both, right? They want their DSL or their UVerse, whatever, and they also want a Wi-Fi in their home. You already have Wi-Fi in your home, so don't use theirs. Turn it off. Your skepticism is very good. And one of the concerns I've got about any time you do a modem, a DSL modem or any kind of modem with the Wi-Fi access point is the protocol for the modem to talk to them requires a certain handshaking that the modem has to be registered with them, right? So they have to know about it at some level. But Wi-Fi access points inherently have a lot of problems with updates. So I always suggest that you update your wireless access point as soon as you possibly can. Sometimes the wireless access point has a firmware upgrade, an upgrade to it that's available outside the company that built it. It's just a completely different one. And you can do that because it's your property. But when you're leasing a modem or you've bought one of their modems, if you update that too much and they don't like and it breaks the connection to the DSL, you've got a problem. Also, you only have one connection point. Your Wi-Fi, there's not another layer of physical routing security that occurs when you've got your router modem plus a Wi-Fi access point after that. So I highly recommend you get your modem, then you get your hardware that would be routing and Wi-Fi. Okay. Or even another layer of that. It adds another layer of security. But the WEP versus WAP, you're correct. Do not use WEP. It's kind of silly. The WEP protocol for wireless, WEP, has been cracked and it shouldn't be around. It's silly. At the same
insecure
time,
is what you're saying.
It's insecure.
Insecure.
Yeah. And the other aspect is that I highly recommend that as you use anything in the internet, that's Wi-Fi or internet based, that you're always using secure protocols. The mail providers are forcing that to happen, so it doesn't matter for mail anymore. You basically have to use the secure protocol. It doesn't matter how you connect if you're using Wi-Fi that's not secure. It won't matter. Your mail is still safe. And then the websites that we visit all the time, Facebook and Twitter and Gmail, all these guys are moving to HTTPS, the secure protocol on top of HTTP. And that also doesn't matter if your wireless is secure, right? So
right.
WAP, WPA, also was insecure. WAP 2 is better. And that's not so true. I'm not sure of the details. It could be that they're both okay and they're different different mechanism for password on top of it. But I would recommend, WPA 2 is definitely one I'd recommend. I think it's probable that WPA is actually WPA 2 and they're not telling you that. But again, because they're providing WEP in there as a feature and because it's integrated with a DSL modem, just don't even use it. Just try to turn it off, and if you can turn it off, you're good, and then use your own stack after that. Okay?
I'm not sure what you mean. Like, if I use their the two-wire modem that the U-verse modem, can I actually turn off the wireless?
Yeah.
I can?
Well, if you can log into it, yeah. You should be able to disable the wireless.
Mm-hmm. And then just use my Apple Airport Express off of one of the router ports, Ethernet ports like I'm using now.
Yeah. And there's two ways to do this, right? I mean, the issue is that the router modem that they gave you, does it have multiple ports on it?
It has four Ethernet ports. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't want to change your system very much at all, you can take one of those Ethernet ports and use it. Don't use anything but that one. And
I don't want to have two Wi-Fi signals in my house, though.
Yeah, but turn off the Wi-Fi of that DSL, of that modem that you got. You should be able to log into that.
That's what I wasn't sure whether I could do that.
Yeah, you can.
Well,
I've never seen an interface on a device that doesn't allow you to turn off the Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So when you log into that modem, disable Wi-Fi. Once you've done that, it's going to still provide DHCP protocol out of you, all the ports. Take one of those ports, plug it into your existing router as the what's called WAN port normally, W-A-N, Wide Area Network. Your existing router should have some ports that are the same and one port that's different. And
right.
That port is the public internet, if you will. And you would normally right. connect that into your modem. So you plug that into their device and you're done. That's all you need.
But then I don't know if I need another router. I have an old D-Link. Then I'd have two Ethernet routers, and I'd have...
You don't need to.
Yeah,
you don't need to have that other router, but there is more security by having it.
But I'd have two levels of network address translation, right?
That's right.
And then how do I configure that?
Well, it's actually all going to work for you already because the existing router that you had, at one point you were plugging into a device that was giving an IP address. And
would have been my ADSL modem.
Right. So what you do is instead of plugging into that modem, you plug it into one of the ports of this new modem they've given you.
Right.
And though there's a possibility that you have the same IP range, that could be problematic, but most likely it won't be. And you'll get in a situation where you'll have two layers of network, but you'll never use that first network layer. And the only side effect that you could potentially see is that if the two-wire router has a problem with HTTP caching, and it probably does. You were probably better off before you switched to the U-verse solution.
For various reasons.
Okay, so I might be able to call him. It's not going to take effect until Monday at 8 p.m., so maybe I could call him and cancel it. But
well, keep in mind that the U-verse solution that they sent you, that modem package, whatever, that's just a modem that they know will work with their system.
Yeah.
The settings in that thing,
supposedly,
the settings in that thing, your other modem will do the same thing. All you have to do is tell them that you've already have a different modem. So when you set up the service, unplug this one that they sent you, put it on the side because they're going to charge you every month for it. You got to send it back, maybe.
Yeah.
Take the existing ADSL modem that you have, plug it into the phone the normal way, and when you're talking through them, explain this is the model of the DSL modem you have. And just use your old one.
Maybe I could use the existing modem
with
a higher speed?
Yes, your DSL modem probably won't be the speed problem. Now, what you want to do is take a look at your current modem, get the model number, do some research online, and see if what its performance is like. And you'll be able to find the new one rated as well. Of course, they're going to put a sticker of U-verse name on it, but really it's, as you know, a two-wire solution that's probably really, really inexpensive because they're giving it to everybody. And really, really inexpensive hardware is worse because it doesn't have the kind of performance characteristics as better hardware. And it's mostly about cooling and component quality. So what they're going to do with this two-wire solution is they're going to make it really solid to run and work, but not beefed up on performance, right? And
they're going for endurance over performance.
Yeah. Which is, you know, kind of a good thing.
So, I mean, so your advice is to avoid UVerse completely, and then, but
will you can't
offer me 6 megabit at, at their regular DSL?
No, I don't think they will. I mean, they might, since you're an old customer, but no. The UVerse package is their new way of labeling DSL. It's nothing, there's nothing different. The only thing that's, I don't like the disingenuous quality of it.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's basically, their new providing solution is going to be UVerse. And there is reasons for that, as I covered already. Thank you, Tony. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tony from San Jose. Now, we also have someone from San Juan Bautista. Should we just jump right in? I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Ramona, right?
Yeah. Ramona, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, Lyle. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Lyle. This is my first time hearing your show.
Oh, welcome.
Oh, cool.
Oh, gosh. I can't hear you very well, though. Let's see if I can turn up my volume. Well, I wish I talked to you before I had UVerse. I am calling because I'm running Vista, and I recently purchased QuickBooks and installed it on that computer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came, it apparently, came with some kind of syncing program. And, or, I don't really know what that is. It just kind of, it pops up at the start of the computer. My husband's kind of annoyed because he thinks it's making the computer run slow. He wants to disable it, but I don't know what it is. And so I don't know if I need it. I don't know if my operating system is a problem. You have any ideas about that?
Yeah, is this called the Intuit Sync? Does it say Intuit Sync Manager or something like that? Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So, Intuit, the people that make QuickBooks and Quicken, they have all their online service providing capabilities. And when they sell you a product, they also want to extend a monthly contract with you that allows you to access your data in other ways. This is a very cool feature. It does some things that I think is great when you need it. But by default, they install it for everybody. Most likely, you're not using their online services. You didn't sign up for that. If you had, you'd know why you have that installed. And so it's trying to do this, and then it doesn't because the account's not set up, and then it goes away. And I think it's probably a real problem for Intuit. They shouldn't have done this because, of course, it's annoying you, really, and you're not getting any service out of it. But the idea behind it is, let's say you've done all your paperwork, all your business work, and the entire time they're syncing all your data to their servers. And then your hard drive crashes, and you go, ah! And you go, oh, wait, Intuit had a syncing thing. And you contact them. They say, yeah, we got all your data. You're totally good. Not losing your books is really cool, right?
So it's like a backup in the cloud, basically.
It is. And they offer other service providing capabilities. Like Intuit will sell you the tax stuff that you need to do. And since they have all your records. But there is a bit of a privacy concern, right? If they're taking all of your booking information and getting a copy of it, what's their rule set on that? And so here's the simple solution. Turn the friggin' thing off. You don't need it. Unless, of course, you definitely need it, in which case you'll know. So
I do have also their program called GoPayment, which allows me to accept credit card payments. I haven't really had many credit card payments or had to input them into my QuickBooks yet, but will the syncing be required once that's operational?
It shouldn't.
Okay.
I mean, the only thing that's clever about it is that if you are doing a credit card payment through them, when the payment goes through, your local system wouldn't know until you check it somehow and then edit it, or you let the sync happen, right? So that you're going to process the credit card transaction. You probably don't need sync to do that. And then once it completes or finishes or gets rejected, the syncing would allow your QuickBooks to have that information, and so you'd lose that capability. It's possible that they say, actually, you know what? If you're going to use these cards, you've got to have sync on, but the answer to the question is whether it's slowing the machine down. Probably not. They're a pretty on top of it company. You know, they can't have a lot of bugs. They're dealing with money.
Yeah. Well, what about Vista? Because my husband seems to think, Vista, doesn't interface with programs, and that's is that right?
For Microsoft at this point, if your machine can support it, I highly recommend Windows 7. as the stable, good operating system. It could be that 8 is going to be great, Metro is going to be great, whatever, but right now I'm saying stay with 7. If you can get off of Vista, if you can upgrade to 7, go for it. But upgrading Windows is not a joyous experience. So it's not like you're like, oh, fun, today I get to update my computer. Click. And because of that, if you're not having problems, wait. You know, like maybe you get to Vista when you buy a new computer, or get out of Vista when you buy a new computer. Mm. If you feel like it's time to do it, or you know a geek that likes to do that kind of thing, and there are geeks that do that, and you know what that geek's joy is, if you know she really likes wonderful dinners, then you invite her over and you say, hi, how can you do dinner and also install Vista, and or install 7? And it might be more joyous to actually make an evening of it, you know?
Oh, my gosh, I think I lost my question. But, like this. Like, if I get a new computer, I mean, maybe there's someone else to ask about this, but, you know, my QuickBooks is on this computer. It's got all the data in it. That's all transferable to a different computer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and actually, during the install of operating systems, it's very common for the operating system to say, do you want to migrate your data? And you can do it then, which I normally don't, but I recommend other people do. You can do the migration then, or you can choose to do the migration after with the same application. And I can't remember what it's called, but it's in utility. You know, you can find it pretty easily. It's a migration assistant kind of thing. And the only trick with it is you have to connect those computers together somehow. And and that's a little tricky in the sense that, you know, you got to make the new computer has to be able to read the old computer's information. If it's the same computer, it's during the install process. It'll actually detect Windows and hopefully do that for you. But before you upgrade your operating system, before you do that, make sure the files that you would be sad about losing, you have a copy of them on a different hard drive completely. I highly recommend having an external hard drive like a USB or FireWire drive and copy the data onto that before doing a major update like that so that at least you don't lose your data. It might still be 2 days of pain, but at the end of it, you'll still have your photographs. Thank you. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Ramona from San Juan Batista, which is great. We have San Juan Batista in our coverage range.
Do we have what?
San Juan Batista in our coverage range?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's great.
Yeah.
I was listening to KSP all the way over the hill yesterday. It was wonderful. Must have been good at the... Okay, any case. More news do we have? I have a bit of a story from the week about opening up devices, and I realized, you know, I don't do a lot of technical stuff in the explanations, and we could go into that space of, this is the story about an iPhone case and batteries.
Okay, so Geek's Got a Geek, right? This is a story about a day in the life of a geek.
Yeah.
So what happened? You had a case that needed...
Quite a while ago, I buy an iPhone 4, and I'm under contract and all that, and they're expensive devices. And one of the things about Apple that they've been doing, we cover on this show over and over, they are making devices lighter and smaller and faster and all these things. But they're integrating the technology so much so that it is very hard to fix them or upgrade them later. Mm-hmm. So in the iPhone, for example, there is a lithium-ion battery, and that battery... It used to be, remember your cell phone? You used to have a battery you could take out and put back in? Like that was a common thing for cell phones?
Yeah.
It's a little door. Maybe you had to have a screw.
Are we not doing that now? I haven't really checked it out.
We're not doing it at all. Yeah.
My old phone fell into the drink and I've got this smartphone now and it's a relatively unexamined device.
Yeah, and it's possible your phone has a replaceable battery because you have an Android phone, right?
What do I? No, I've got one of those Windows Nokia things.
Ooh, really? I will look at it later today. Okay, any case, the iPhone's battery is integrated in, and opening the thing is kind of difficult. There's all instructions on how to do that. You have to use a spudger, the plastic tool. It's like a spatula, little spatula, and you break it open, and it's kind of a mess. The iPhone's actually more complicated than that. iFixit, this website, will actually have a video on how to do it.
Oh.
But I've opened iPhones before, and I've opened small devices. Okay. And when you put them back together, it's painful. I hate doing it. Okay, so I decided, you know what I'd like to do is protect this battery's life. And I know, and I think all of you should know, that lithium-ion batteries, the best way to protect their life is to keep them charged all the time. Never let them go down.
Okay. Can we just do like a quick sidebar?
Yeah.
Because I am eternally confused which batteries I am recharging when they go down, and that's the better things to do.
Yes.
And which one I should keep charged all the time. Is there some sort of unifying characteristic of which is which, or do I just have to remember it by rote from device to device?
You have to know which kind of battery you have. If you have a Nikon... There's two different types of battery charging types, right? Uh-huh. One of them, yes, you want it to let it go down to its base level and come back up. And then there's the ones that are in all of our devices now. Mm. In your laptop, in your phone, those are all lithium-ion.
Lithium-ion
batteries, you do not need them to do a duty cycle, going down all the way and going back up again.
Okay.
It is good to do that every once in a while, but regularly that's the worst thing you can do for the battery's life.
Ooh.
So what I recommend is if you can plug in your device for charging, do so. And in knowing that and knowing that it's hard to open my iPhone, yeah. I try to plug it in all the time. I'm constantly doing that.
Yeah.
And that can get, I get a little neurotic about it, right?
Yeah. So
I came up with a solution.
So you came up with a solution.
Yeah. I don't like being neurotic. So I went, well, wait a second. There's these iPhone cases that actually have a built-in battery in it. And that thing's a $40 case, right? So if I take my iPhone, which is expensive, and I put it in a case that has another built-in battery into it, and then I'm always at night charging that battery, my iPhone never actually uses its battery because it always has a bit of a charge from the case. Okay?
Okay.
And then when... And the idea being here is that eventually when my iPhone doesn't last a whole day and I want to go hiking, I've got a problem, right? So it degrades the quality of the iPhone if the battery gets degraded. Mm-hmm. And it's expensive to replace and hard to do. All right. So I'm thinking, well, if I can save that pain by getting a case that has a battery in it. And that case is 40 or 80. It was some money that was kind of serious. So I start using the case and it's awesome. Mm-hmm. I charge the iPhone. I charge the case. During the night, I can charge the case. I can even sync through the case. Like, everything working great. And then my iPhone always has a full charge. So at the end of a long day of watching YouTube videos all day long, the battery at about 5 o'clock in the evening, then my case is dead and my iPhone is starting to use its battery.
Yeah.
Which is really good for the iPhone's battery.
Okay. So that's what you want to have happen.
That's what I want to have happen.
Got it.
So I get this case. I'm bragging about it to my geek friends and chatting about it. I might have mentioned on the show. And then I start having this problem where the battery is not charging at night. And I realize that the case has a problem with it, a physical problem.
Oh, your fix needs a fix.
Yes. So now the case is using a micro USB. This is the really small USB thing that you probably have on an older device, and it's kind of flimsy. There's three levels of USB. There's micro, there's mini, there's A and B. And anyway, this is micro, the smallest one. It's kind of a curved-looking trapezoid. So trapezoid with a kind of curve at one side. All right. Really thin. Mm-hmm. And it's problematic. So I have to put a book on top of the cable. You know, all of us have done this before. Wiggle a cable until the light turns on, and then we kind of keep it there at night. And that's working for a while until it doesn't work anymore. So I take it to work, and I get out the spudger, which is this cool little spatula thing.
Spatula
really, I use a plastic blade. I don't know what it is.
Is it just for popping off the difficult panels?
You'll notice these little devices. They just have a seam, and there's no screws.
Right.
How do you do that? Well, you just take a plastic thing and just wedge it in there, and it goes...
It has to be thin enough.
It has to be thin enough and has to be strong enough, and then you have to do it in such a way that you don't break the tabs, but you will.
Yeah.
Okay, so I break part of the tabs open, and then I get it open, and I got pictures I'll put up on Geekspeak about this. And inside it is a small electronics board called a PCB, a printed circuit board. And that is the basis for all electronics in our society. We print sheets of fiberglass that with copper on them, and we cut off the copper and make these wires on top of them, and we put components on top of it. And it used to be that all the components we put through would have a hole through it, and it would be physically really strong because a wire would go through the board, and we'd fill that break with solder. And you make jewelry, don't you? Do you solder?
I don't solder, but Daddy did growing up. And in fact, there was a lot of when things got emotionally tense in the household, he'd go to the back room and solder. There's a lot of soldering solace that happened in the back room. But he'd also wire wrap his own circuit boards.
Yeah, that's another way to do it instead of PCBs.
He built my first computer.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I come from geeks.
Yeah. So wire wrapping, instead of a printed board, you actually have a whole bunch of little wires wrapped around posts. But anyway, the printed boards that we all are using, this actually defines how all of our stuff works. Like the way our cases work, the way our connectors work. If you look on the back of a device, you'll see all these plugs and points. Uh-huh. Those are actually attached to a board. And the reason they do it that way instead of having wires is that a wire needs a human being. But the boards are actually computerly placed. All these little components are put on by a computer robotic arm.
Yeah.
So they print this really complicated schematic, this board, this piece of plastic, and then they place all these parts on it on top now, not even through mount. They do surface mount. They're very small components. They're not really meant for humans, and they're robots that do it. And then the entire board, before the component goes down, they put some paste, which is solder, but in a pasty, sticky way.
Yeah.
Then they bake the entire board at a hot enough temperature for the solder to melt.
Okay.
And then that's it. Right, so no human being actually engages with it.
All right.
All right.
And so this thing was in your case.
Yes, it's very small boards in the case. And the connector that interfaces with the outside world, the weak point, if you will, is a metal casing. It's smaller than my pinky fingernail. It's really small.
Okay.
And that little thing actually has a surface mount component, which is just stuck on top. It also has a couple metal posts that go through the board, a through point, because physically surface mount's not very strong. Solder's actually not strong, right?
Yeah.
So you put it through the board, and then you have a really strong connection.
Okay.
And when I flip over the board and look at the posts that go through, there's no solder in them. I've seen this before. It's a very common problem. When you bake the board, all the components melt, and it functions, and then you test it and it works. But if you haven't even strengthened the integrity of the physical thing,
yeah.
as the wire goes in, those little tiny connections break over time.
Okay, so this thing was broken.
It was broken. And it was broken because of a very simple design problem when they didn't finish soldering it. It might have been they needed to have a human do that, and they didn't have a human do it, or a person made a mistake. So anyway, what I did is solder that up. And it still didn't fix the problem because by that time the connector had been broken. So then I go online and I buy a connector, but the connector's only $1, right? So then I should just fade myself out at this point. You can see that I wanted to make my life simpler. Instead, I spend
like
all this time.
Kind of complicated, Lyle.
It's horribly complicated. So now I'm waiting for components to be shipped to me that cost more to ship than to buy.
Yeah.
Ugh,
after
so
having to figure out what was wrong with a thing that was your fix, your complication had
and complications. And I gotta say, I loved every aspect of it, right? Because figuring that out, knowing that that was the problem and knowing that was so joyous to me, right? It's this hacker mentality. We don't get into our devices, right?
No.
But the thing that's sad is that to save this future problem of not being wasteful and having this device work longer, I buy something that, of course, has waste. I then have to fix something by buying a component that has waste. All of this is shipping costs, right?
Yeah.
I can't beat this battle of it would have been easier to buy a new iPhone when the battery went dead.
Right.
Which is really depressing to me. Why do we live in a society that's so disposable? Even this relatively expert geek can't really do it efficiently enough to make it work. Right.
So there's a couple things there. Darn our consumer culture, but the puzzle love and joy of the geek at work.
You gotta love it. Mm. Absolutely.
Mm-mm-mm. We had a question. We've got someone actually on line 4 from Watsonville. I'm not sure if we can answer his question, though, in the 3 minutes we have left.
Yeah, no, we don't.
He says he's trying to listen to KUSP's stream on his Android phone and running into some snarls. So Benjamin, make sure we've got your contact info and
you know what, Ben, stay online. I'll try to help you out after the show. I think that's probably the best way to go.
There we go.
And so I want to mention that. Let's see. Well, let's do this. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. It's used with permission. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch. I am Lyle Troxell. Answering phones today was Rick Filman, and I thank him very much.
Thank you.
All the stuff we've talked about on Geekspeak today, Bonnie, we're putting up after the show on geekspeak.org so you can learn all about it, including a description on Java exploit from last week. Of course, you can rate us and talk about us online through iTunes or like us on Facebook or Google+. We're all over the place. Please do so. And give us comments. You can email us throughout the week, geeks@geekspeak.org. We'll be here next week. See you then.